From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hey, how about the GOP tax overhaul? You know the one I mean.
It's the largest, I always say the most massive, but it's the largest tax cut in the history of our country. And reform.
Did you know that when the GOP tax overhaul was signed into law last month, it very nearly redefined fetuses as children for tax purposes? That provision was ditched by the Senate just hours before the vote, but it was yet another reminder of an issue so thorny and so tough, it sprouts perennially in all kinds of weather and in every American terrain. Abortion.
This was a case of enormous political significance. Here you had an undocumented, unaccompanied teen in federal custody seeking an abortion, and the Trump administration.
This October, a young Jane Doe, an undocumented immigrant to the United States, sought access to an abortion while in federal custody. She had the funds to afford it herself, but
the Trump administration argues that it does not have to facilitate this abortion. And by facilitate, they mean that they do not have to provide staff to fill out paperwork, to drive her to her counseling appointments or her abortion, or provide her with care after the procedure. They
say two similar cases in December of undocumented teens seeking access to abortions while in federal custody.
Another pivotal case in the effort to allow abortions for illegals. A federal judge ordering the Trump administration to allow two illegal immigrant teens to terminate their pregnancies.
This time, when a D.C. federal judge granted the two teens access to abortion, the Department of Justice immediately appealed to the federal judge and to the Supreme Court. The everlasting thrust and parry over abortion, where for both sides, the stakes literally are life and death. Why this battle is never resolved is the subject for this hour. It first aired this summer because abortion has come to mean much more than a medical procedure. It's a symbol of liberty or licentiousness, a display of decency or degradation, an emblem of all that is fair or foul in America. New Yorker staff writer and Harvard history professor Jill Lepore says it wasn't always that way.
Abortion before what's known as quickening, which is when a mother can feel the movement of a fetus, which is around 4 months, is not a crime in the colonies in most places. Criminal codes begin in the 1820s with the rise of the medical profession taking over from midwives.
And I guess we could hop to Margaret Sanger at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah. So Margaret Sanger, who's the founder of the birth control movement, the founder of Planned Parenthood with her sister Ethel Byrne in 1916, they opened the first birth control clinic, is not herself a proponent of the legalization of abortion. What Sanger and her sister and the founders of Planned Parenthood are trying to do in the 19-teens is decriminalize contraception, and a kind of moral crusade of Anthony Comstock, who in 1873 argues that even talking about contraception is an obscene activity and needs to be criminalized. And Sanger and her sister, who are both nurses and who are both mothers, come from a very large family, a family of 11 children. Their mother died of tuberculosis at a very young age. There's plenty of birth control available to wealthy people who use it. The number of children of wealthy families decreases very quickly over the course of the 19th century. It's the poor who are having abortions and dying from them. So Sanger and her sister are campaigning to decriminalize birth control, partly as a remedy for abortion.
Suggestions as to what to be done for a girl who was in trouble or a married woman who was caught passed from mouth to mouth, turpentine, steaming, rolling downstairs, knitting needles, shoe hooks. When they had word of a new remedy, they hurried to the drugstore, and if the clerk were inclined to be friendly, he might say, "Oh, that won't help you. But here's something that will."
Sanger had actually been pushed out of Planned Parenthood, then run by men who were doctors, obstetricians, because she was too feminist and because Planned Parenthood was essentially a very Republican organization. Eisenhower was on a family planning committee in the 1960s. Barry Goldwater was on a Planned Parenthood committee, so was his wife.
Take me back to 65, the Griswold decision. The Supreme Court ruled 7-2 that Connecticut's ban on contraception was unconstitutional on the grounds of a married couple's right to privacy. I find this is so interesting because privacy seems to be constantly weaving in and out of the legal debate over abortion rights.
Yeah, and I think it's actually a tragic ruling, frankly, for women's equal rights campaigns. When women involved in the reproductive rights movement in the early 1960s tried to bring a case using the 14th Amendment to say that it was a violation of the equal protection of the law for women to not be able to hear from their doctors about contraception. And the court refused that argument, and they selected a case where they thought that they could defend a decision to strike down the bans on contraception using a privacy argument, which turns out to be, in my view, kind of a dead end. If you think about the divergence between, say, the reproductive rights movement and gay rights and same-sex marriage rights, the gay rights movement made a right to privacy argument as well, but without success. And in fact, when you think about it, the sort of 1980s, 1990s come out of the closet sort of AIDS ACT UP moment was very much about refusing to hide one's sexuality. They wanted the equal protection of the law and they fought for it. And yet women have kind of inherited this right to privacy argument because that's what the Supreme Court was more comfortable with when talking about women. And it's actually a very Victorian notion.
But isn't it privacy that leads to Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, Roe v. Wade cites that same right to privacy.
And they talk about the shadow cast by the notion of privacy, which is never stated in the Constitution, which many legal scholars say make it an extraordinarily weak decision. Right?
Right. That's what William O. Douglas and the court did in Griswold, was say, well, okay, the right to privacy is not in the Constitution, but you can find it if you look between the letters and the words in the First Amendment, you can infer it. And he's resting on an argument that was made in 1890 by Louis Brandeis and his law partner, Samuel Warren, that is entirely bound out with Victorian notions of femininity. Brandeis and Warren said the right to privacy can be understood to be in the Constitution because it protects us against the incursions of modern technology that might pry into private life. And they were particularly concerned about their wives and their daughters, say. They were really concerned about cameras, women being caught on camera.
It sucks their souls, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But Douglas kind of pulls it and puts it into the context of, basically, it's about the vagina.
You know, right.
What I mean? Like, that's private. It is not the same as making a case using the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It's not as sturdy as that, and it has come under very, very strong attack.
Something else not mentioned explicitly in the Constitution, women. And if you're not going to talk about women, then you've noted that people have to find rights for themselves in the margins in the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights and the Constitution contain soaring language, but these documents were written at a time when a large number of people who are now U.S. citizens were not considered eligible for full citizenship. And so when there are arguments to be made in a court of law about the rights of those of us, they take a certain amount of contortion. 30 years of legal argument in the 19th century was about whether the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution included black people. And that was an argument that was won. It's been a very long struggle after winning that legal argument to win it in the streets and in state houses. But it was a legal argument that had to be made to resolve the ambiguity in those documents.
You note that in the vanguard of these family planning efforts in the 60s were Republicans. When Title X was passed, which provided family planning services, it passed with bipartisan support. Nixon signed it. Then a year later, part of Title X, which had an allowance for military doctors to perform abortions, was revoked by Nixon. Something happened.
Yeah, and what's happening is Nixon, who had been pro-family planning, is greatly influenced by his speechwriter, Pat Buchanan. Nixon is just completely obsessed with re-election. And Buchanan says, you know what, you're going to have to switch your position on abortion because the Pope had decried it and it was a deep and powerful moral issue for the church. If you change your position, then the Catholics will have to move to the Republican Party. And this is at a time when Nixon is undertaking his Southern strategy to recruit white Democrats with his law and order rhetoric. And much less attended is this, you know, what I think of as the female strategy, which is to say, you know, we can bring Catholics into this new Republican coalition over the abortion issue. Buchanan and other conservative Republican strategists take a lot of credit for this move, but really it's Phyllis Schlafly, very hardworking Republican Party activist from Illinois, who brings that pro-family conservatism into the Republican Party.
The Republican Party continues to uphold the principle that every human being, born and unborn, young and old, healthy and disabled, has a fundamental individual right to life.
She allies two completely different political constituencies. People who are opposed to the ERA, which looks like it's about to be ratified, and people who are opposed to abortion. And she brings into the Republican Party evangelical Christians. Schlafly and her supporters argue that 1960s liberalism celebrates the individual and promotes the rights of the individual at the expense of the family and at the expense of a kind of moral order that abortion becomes a linchpin for. The party leadership switches earlier following Schlafly. The Republican Party had first endorsed the Equal Rights Amendment in 1940. It had been on its plank every 4 years since 1940. And Schlafly convinces the GOP to get it off the plank.
She famously said, feminism is doomed to failure because it is based on an attempt to repeal and restructure human nature. And she said, sex education classes are like in-home sales parties for abortions.
She's incredibly effective, turning the position of the Republican Party 180 degrees away from what it had been for a very long time.
So Nixon was reelected in November of 72, and that was 8 days after the Supreme Court issued its ruling on Roe v. Wade.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government. Thus, the anti-abortion laws of 46 states were rendered unconstitutional.
In 1975, when Betty Ford is in the White House, Morley Schaefer from CBS comes to interview her for 60 Minutes. And they have this incredible conversation. He says, I'm going to ask you about some taboo subjects. What are your views on abortion? And she says,
I feel very strongly that it was the best thing in the world when the Supreme Court voted to legalize abortion and, in my words, bring it out of the backwoods and put it in the hospitals where it belonged. I thought it was a great, great decision.
Betty Ford was perfectly willing to say what a lot of Republican women felt. And a lot of those women then left the party, and it completely transformed the party system.
After Roe, Planned Parenthood was forced to pick a side. Are you in favor of abortion rights or not? How could they not be in favor of abortion rights?
One of the things that happened after Roe, and especially after 1977, was that the women's movement came to understand itself as the pro-choice movement, which really narrowed the movement and also left outside and abandoned all the other issues that women had been fighting for. So that's not Planned Parenthood's fault. Planned Parenthood is a health service provider, but it also has an advocacy arm and made a decision to defend abortion rights.
And Planned Parenthood has been stuck in this same defensive crouch for about 40 years. But abortion just doesn't seem to move.
Yeah, but abortion is a really complicated issue. It is the analog to the gun ownership issue before the 1970s, and they're not partisan issues. And then they become hyper-partisan issues. They're super polarizing, and they both, to people, feel like they're about life and death. Either guns are murder or they're freedom. Either abortion is murder or it's freedom. And it's that there's like a grid. Like, you have on one axis, you have abortion and guns, and on the other axis, you have murder or freedom. But the illusion is that this grid is somehow natural. Like, these are just how these issues are in the world. They're how these issues have been shaped by people with nakedly self-serving partisan interests. The political intensity of it, that's an artifice.
Jill Lepore is a professor of American history at Harvard University and a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Coming up, Miss Sherry's abortion expedition takes her from Romper Room to Sweden to the cover of Life magazine. This is On the Media.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.